Hello, welcome to Prime Lenses. I'm Ian. Each week, I speak with a guest about three lenses that have meant something to them on their photographic journey. And my guest this week is James Toccio. James founded the Casual Photophile website over a decade ago, and since then has tinkered with, fixed, played with, photographed with, done everything with just about every type of camera and lens combination that you can think of. Film, digital, instant, carved into stone practically, like he's seen and done it all. So I was really excited when he said yes to come onto the show because I had a feeling that he would pick some interesting lenses, and whilst a couple of them you may well have heard of, there is one in there that I'm almost certain that a lot of people won't have heard of. So that's quite exciting. He was fantastic company. We've got a lot in common, as you'll hear from the beginning of the conversation. So without further ado, here is James.
How's it going?
Yeah, really
good. To finally see you.
Yes, you too. I mean, you know, we both seem to love video games, motorcycles, and cameras. I cannot imagine what we'll talk about. Like, I just don't...
Yeah, no, there's nothing interesting.
No, there's going to be anything. I mean, you've got a Virtual Boy in the background. We've got to start there.
Yeah, that's right. I do, yeah. I got a lot of stuff in the background. This is like my office of never growing up.
Nice. Brilliant. Yeah. I think we all should aspire to having one of those.
Why not?
The only thing I've got kind of handy next to me is my PSP Go. So listen to called Into the Aether, and they do these kind of retrospectives where they look at old consoles again. And I've got my PSP Go out.
Wow. Yeah, I love that thing. I never got one of those, but it was always, you know, like a very flashy little piece of kit.
Yes.
But it's like you have a PSP at the time, you know, you got a PSP. It's like...
Yeah. Oh, hang on. That's the game is talking to me in the background. Yes. PSP Go is great. The sliding mechanism on this thing, though, is so cool.
Yeah.
It's very Sony. Cool. It's very Sony. The engineering is just extremely clever. It's got that thing of how is this thin and still does the thing it's supposed to do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool.
It's like Sony Ericsson.
Mm.
Sliding phones, and you know, those were very cool back in the day, you know, before iPhones.
Yeah. I had a friend who was working, I think enough time has probably passed. In fact, they may have shipped the product. He was working for Samsung at the time that the iPhone came out. And he was in Seoul when they managed to get an iPhone the day they came out. And they were working on a collaboration with Bang & Olufsen on a weird phone, and it was very Bang & Olufsen, so it had bits that folded and it was like round at the bottom, and like you could stand it on a table to be a speakerphone. Like they had all these kind of like half cooked ideas of what the kind of all-in-one device could become, and then they saw an iPhone and they were just like oh no. it turns out because they until they had it in their hand, they were like, but it can't possibly work as well as the video makes it look. They would, you know, the animations were so smooth, it was so responsive, that first version of the software, like as limited as it was, felt to me as a consumer fairly bulletproof, and they were just like, no, this thing, it's gonna ruin our day.
It's a game changer, right? Changed the whole world.
Yeah, and changed apparently it was however many years ago today that they unveiled it.
Yeah, what, 18 years or something?
Yeah, 18 years of iPhone, well, 17 years or something.
Yeah, madness. Something like that. Madness. It's like they should have had that catchphrase that Sony had with the PS3, which was "it only does everything." Mm. That's Apple should have had that catchphrase or slogan.
Yeah, they are funny with the slogans because I feel like they have a few things they hang their hat on, like the piece of glass idea. Like they get an idea, they get very fixated on an idea. Yeah. I feel like
for better or worse.
I was just gonna say exactly that. Yeah. That's kind of how they roll. I think now these days they're so big. It's you know, you get to a certain size, you can't say anything whimsical anymore.
No. You talk about this on your podcast all the time. Like every guest you have, there's some Apple or tech connection. I've noticed that.
I think it's maybe being a modern human. Like I think because the tech companies became culture to some extent in a way that like when we were growing up, like because we're of a similar vintage, I'm guesstimating. Yeah. So when we were growing up, like computers, there was like a room maybe you had your computer in.
Yeah.
You know,
the computer room.
You had to go and use it. You had to go and turn it on. Whereas now this stuff is kind of everywhere. So the impact these things had was really significant to us. Whereas like my kids, when they were toddlers, were going up to the TV trying to touch it because they assumed it was a touchscreen.
Why is this not a touchscreen? Everything's a touchscreen.
Yeah. So so it's a very different, I think for us, it holds a little bit more allure and sway because we remember what the world was like without it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it holds allure. It holds some negative things as well, I think. Sometimes it's like, but it's nice. You can shut these things off. Some people talk about technology like, oh, it's ruining everything. It's like, you can just shut the stuff off. Just go outside. That's part of the film camera, the allure of film cameras. You know, you get outside, you're not touching technology. I mean, it's technology, but it's mechanical technology or analog technology. So, yeah.
Do you think that kind of, because I was talking with someone on Blue Sky today about, they shoot an M5. I've always fancied a Leica M5. I think, you know, I think they're cool looking. Just think they're kind of like an alternate timeline camera. You know, it's like, here's what it could have been. But yeah. He shoots with that, and he was talking to me about digital. I'm very wedded to digital in a way that when I shoot film, I sometimes feel like a fraud because I feel like this isn't really where I discovered photography. It's a bit like when actors say, oh, I yearn for the stage. And you're like, do you? Are you sure? Mm-hmm. Or are you just saying that because actors you admire are on stage? So I with film, I think I'm kind of honest with myself and like, I don't have the patience for it. But how do you feel? Because you presumably started, I mean, as many of us did, with film. Does it impact your process now, or do you still shoot a lot of film?
Yeah, I shoot a lot of film. I mean, I think I certainly started shooting film first. But no, to be honest, when I was shooting film cameras, it was very much just like the early days of not film or photography, but my life. I was a kid. So I wasn't thinking about composition. I wasn't thinking about, you know, photography with a capital P. I was just taking fun pictures of stuff I saw. When I actually got into photography, it was with digital. So it's actually been kind of interesting to come from like very, very casual film photography to getting really into photography with digital and then sort of rediscovering film back in like, you know, 2014 or so. And then getting really into that. So, but no, I mean, today and for the past 5 to 10 years, I've been shooting both and loving both. I just like photography, so I don't really care too much about how the image is made. I'm not like a snob about it either way, you know. We just have fun. That's the casual photophile. It's chill. these things are here to have fun, not get upset about. So
the clue's in the title, isn't it? And
it is. Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you about the origins of the website because you write a lot, like you write about video games, you take a lot of photos, you share a lot of like your passions and stuff on socials and things. But as someone else who also has written about video games and has wanted to write about things and produce things about what they're passionate about, right? Like get excited and have an excuse to talk to other people. What prompted you to start the site? Because on the one hand, the easier route is potentially to try and find freelance gigs, write about it for other people and things like that.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
What kind of nudged you? What made you go, I'm buying the domain. I'm doing this.
Yeah, I don't know if that's easier, but it's more lucrative for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, you make more money if someone's paying you to write stuff. I mean, and that's what I've been doing for the past couple of years when I decided like, I need more income from my writing work. So that's when I've expanded, I guess, my personal portfolio into video game writing. But yeah, to start the website, I went to school to be a writer. That was my goal in life, was to just, you know, I wanted to write stories. And for, you know, 5 to 8 years, maybe, I really didn't do much with it. I just wrote in my free time. And those stories just went into a hard drive and disappeared forever, you know, never to be seen. So starting around like 2014, I started to get really into photography again, you know, for the first time since like being in college. And at the same time, it was like, wow, these are really cool. And I really want to start, you know, actually publishing material and getting, you know, putting stuff out there, seeing if people want to read it. So I said, well, this is a good spot to just sort of jump into. Like, you know, I have a subject. Yeah. I don't have to think of something new every week. it's going to be cameras. It's going to be photography. It's going to be lenses. It's going to be my experiences with discovering this again. And that's how it started 10 years ago. Remarkably, I can't believe it's been 10 years. So, but it's been good.
Yeah, I was, because I was looking at the date on the bottom and I was thinking, because I remember coming across the site, I think fairly early on.
Oh, yeah.
And it being, I really like the way, to embarrass you slightly, like I really like the way that you approach writing about things. It's not a review. It's kind of a personal experience, which I think is, you were actually early, I think, to that. Like a lot of things have moved in that direction. YouTube is that, you know, a lot of things have moved in the kind of like the personal experience. Did you just feel in your bones that like that's going to be more interesting for people?
Well, here's exactly what happened. In 2014, I discovered my digital camera in the basement. Right. Mm. And I was like, oh, I haven't shot this since college. I've written about this whole experience actually years later on the site. So people that maybe know the site might actually recognize this idea from that article if they have a really good memory. But I found the camera and I was like, there was some stuff going on in life. And I was like, I just need to get out, take some pictures, unwind a little bit, get my mind off of certain things and get them onto something else that's constructive, that's making something, and making photos is constructive. So I went out to Boston at like 3 a.m. and I was like, I'm just going to take pictures of the city where, when no one's around. That's what I want to do. I just want quiet. I want it to be calm and just spend some time alone. So I did that for a night, sort of refigured out how cameras work, how photography works, the exposure triangle and all that. Got home. It was a weekend. It was Saturday morning, I think. And then I was like, I want to read about this stuff too. So I go on the internet and I'm looking up photography stuff. And your listeners may be familiar with this phenomenon, but at that time especially, lots of negativity. Lots of snarkiness, lots of gatekeeping, right? A lot of like, hey, I have got a question about this. And then the response is, how could you not know how to do this or that? Or like, this is way overexposed. This is, you know, your point of focus is way off. Just a lot of criticism, right? And I was like, I don't like this. I don't like this vibe. Like on these forums, it was mostly forums, I think. I was like, there's just a lot of people taking this too seriously. So, you know, 6 months went by or whatever, and I was still trying to find that, like, find that place where you could go on the internet and be welcomed and sort of like share your stuff and get nothing but positivity back. And it really, there wasn't a lot out there. And so one day I was like, I could probably write about this stuff and just encourage people. And that's how the whole site started. I was like, I found a cool camera. I'm going to write a review. And it just went from there. And surprisingly, it worked.
10 years later, here you are.
Yeah. 10 years later, here I am taking basically December off.
Yes.
That's what's happened this year is I've been doing this a long time. Mm. And I was just kind of like mid-December. I was like, I'm going to just take a little break. So it's been about 3 weeks of not writing about cameras for about 3 weeks, which is never happened for me,
right?
For me in the last 10 years. So.
Oh, wow.
But if anyone's listening and they're like, they go to the site and they're fans of the site, which I appreciate, and they're like, what's going on? We haven't seen an article in 3 weeks. Just, I will say, hang in there. You know, 1 week from now, we're going to have some great stuff coming out. So,
yeah, maybe something you like a bit more than that, like a Digilux as well, which it seems like didn't quite meet expectations.
That was a rough one. That was a rough one. No, they're not all good. That's the thing, too. They're not all good.
As it turns out. Yeah.
Yeah. I've gotten a lot of comments over the years that's like everything you write about, you say you love, which is kind of true because it's an editorial site. I don't write about stuff I don't like. So every now and then there will be a review that's like, or an article or whatever that's like, this camera's terrible, but I don't like doing that. So yeah. So if you go to my site and you're looking for you know, a review of this or that camera and you don't find it, chances are I didn't like it.
You don't need to tell the world about stuff that's bad, that you don't like, or that you can't stand behind. No, I completely agree with that. It's the reason I get comments. So I don't know if you get the same thing. This is a bit inside baseball for people, but, you know, I get flurried, like periods of peaks and troughs of feedback from listeners, which makes total sense. So if I go for too long without hearing from a listener, I start to panic. But then I'm not emailing every podcast I listen to every week going, this one was good. Mm. But I get it in little flurries. And this week has been a flurry of activity, I think, because people have been off work and they've been maybe listening to episodes and you know, getting a lot of feedback.
Yeah, catching up over the holidays.
Yeah, I think so. And so I've heard from a bunch of people that like they like every conversation because it seems like, oh, that was a really nice conversation, and people who get on. So it's like, well, I only invite people on who I think I'll get on with and who I think are cool, right? Like, it's the same thing. It's like, why would I?
Wow, thank you. Yeah. That's high praise.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just a dude in the Highlands making a thing. But it's that thing of course it's going to be good, because I'm not going on the internet picking a fight with someone and going, we should record this fight. Like, that would be insane. Right. No one wants to listen to that.
You don't want to be the Joe Rogan of... camera podcasts.
I think one Joe Rogan is definitely enough Joe Rogans.
Yeah,
I think he's also I was gonna say, I think he owns it. Like, I don't listen to a lot of his stuff, but he is a dude and he's just having a conversation.
He gets a lot of criticism. My comment really wasn't a criticism, but he's a good interviewer. He's a great interviewer. He's fantastic.
Yeah, so. Him and the guy that does Hot Ones are the two Collins kind of stealth amazing.
He's incredible.
He's just brilliant. Like, I watched that and I just think, that's...
I think he owns the podcast now, right? Like, him and his partners bought the podcast from whatever parent company.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
It'll be interesting to see where that goes.
Yeah. But they've got a great format there. They've got a great... Because on paper, it just shouldn't work. Like, when I was first told, go and watch Hot Ones, I was like, are you sure? This seems like a college humor style gag. Like, I don't know whether it will work for more than one. And then it turns out it works, you know, for all of them. So, but you've been planning a lot for this year, haven't you, in terms of like on the subject of taking a break and then coming back? Because you were publishing this week on socials talking about your plan for the year in terms of like number of articles and so setting some goals for yourself there. Is that kind of something that you allowed yourself to reflect on in the time off and now you're trying to like put out there so you can measure against it?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, that's a personal, you know, that wasn't posted on the business's social media or anything like that. So it's not really something that like anybody needs to care about. But that was just sort of my personal reflection back on the year. Like, I actually had a pretty good year. 2022 and 2023 weren't the best, personally or professionally, but 2024 was great. I'm so thankful for the opportunities I've been given in the video game industry. Something that I've been like super passionate about since I was 6 years old, you know, and have thought about these things in a way that is, they're very important to me. So I'm very thankful for the year that I had. But I just wanted to kind of take a break from the race, the online publishing schedule, which is like, really, you got to publish, you know, every few days. And it's tough. It's really tough, especially for someone, you know, that's just doing this without like a real team. I don't really have a lot of people, you know, I've got some writers that help me out here and there. But, you know, the last couple of years, I think, have been tougher for everybody in the States anyway, as far as like, you know, meeting the goals you need to meet financially and where you put your time. So I think there's less, as far as my like core group of people that we had working on the site, they just have less time. And I totally appreciate, you know, that they've got to take care of themselves. So I paid everybody that has ever written for me, which is not something that's very common this kind of publishing space. But, you know, it wasn't a lot of money. So even at that, people got to find that balance. So the post schedule has diminished a little bit. We're trying to just sort of refocus at the end of the year and plan for a good 2025. Hopefully make some stuff that people enjoy.
Yes. Well, watch this space. On the subject of refocusing, then, I will use that as a nice segue onto maybe the first of your three lenses, because you focus lenses. See what I did? So you gave me a couple. The third one might be a mystery one, or it'll be a surprise to me as well.
You figured it out? Determined it, yeah. I went through. So that's another thing about this website I've got. Everything I've done is online. So I may not remember this or that, but I had like six or seven lenses in my mind. That's that's the other side of the double-edged sword, is I've shot so much stuff. You asked me to pick three lenses? That's so difficult.
Yes.
I think listeners will probably relate to that too, as they, I can imagine someone listening to this and they turn and look at their shelf of camera gear and it's just stacks and stacks, you know?
Yep.
But yeah, so I did find the third one.
Okay.
So we'll start with the first one.
Yeah. Which
one
do you start with? The first one,
which is the Contax G mount, planar 45 F2, which I have here. No one's seeing this in the podcast, but we're on a video call.
Yeah.
And we can see it here. So
it's a bit of a legend, that one. I've never shot it.
It is a legend. You never shot it. Okay. You don't shoot a lot of film. I know from your from listening to this show. You don't you're a digital guy. You can adapt these to digital. I would recommend that you give it a try.
Okay.
Adapt this to digital. Yeah. It's a great lens to shoot digitally.
Yeah.
It's a little challenging. When I wrote about this years ago now, one of the big points of that writing, that article, was that it is a challenge to shoot these adapted digitally, which is, I think, something that kind of holds them back a little bit.
Right.
You've got to get a special adapter, because these were electronic focus.
Yes.
So focus by wire and manual focus. And so you needed to get an adapter that had a manual focus ring built into it and all that stuff, which you can do and it works. It's not the most elegant solution, but I think the results are worth it. I looked back at my article of this lens just this morning to refresh my mind. And yeah, just looking at the pictures, I'm like, oh, that's beautiful. That's a great shot of my old dog. And, you know, it's like, oh man, I've never seen I can't imagine another lens that can take this sort of picture.
Yeah.
So yeah, you just get lost in these things if you're a camera nerd.
It's also nice and small though, isn't it? It's compact.
Yeah.
I feel like if I was going to shoot it, I'd have to shoot it on the original body. Really, to kind of like properly do it, like to actually run a spool of film through something. Yeah, there you go. Oh, yeah. They look so good in that kind of champagne finish as well.
Yeah, I'm great holding cameras. A Contax G1 for the listening audience. Have you ever heard this Contax shutter?
No.
Let me treat you to this.
Okay.
I'm gonna put,
here we go.
This is the ASMR portion of the recording. It's got a nice shutter sound, right?
It does.
It's beautiful. It's one of my favorites. I mean, this is. We're getting into real camera nerd stuff here.
Good.
But
good.
This is one of my favorite. I can't even say this sentence without kind of laughing at myself. This is one of my favorite shutter sounds of all time.
It's a great choice. I love a good shutter sound because it's one of the reasons I liked, I had an M10 and I moved to the 11, partly because I've said this before on the podcast, but like I got a bonus and it was like, right, this may never happen again. If I don't do this now, I may never get the chance to do this. But also, it's quieter. And what I wanted was something a little bit more discreet, like an M10P or an M11. And then I thought, well, I'll just get the one with the biggest number. And also, I work for a company called Double 11, so having an M11 seemed appropriate, and you know, until they do an M22. So yeah, but no, I do like, because it's the same when you shoot like Polaroid. Like, the sound of Polaroid and the way when it pushes, it just sounds great. Yeah, like an SLR 680.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. The gears grinding and pushing the the film through the rollers. Yeah, it's beautiful.
No, more cameras like that, please. I also know, I know, I'm pretty certain that lens can be modified for people take them apart and rehouse them with a native M mount and a manual focus.
Yep, that's right. They put them in a helicoid so that you can rotate it, you know, nice and smooth without the electronic focusing. Probably money, you know. Probably big money to do that conversion. But I think this is one of the best lenses of the entire film era. Like I think you know, we can separate it from film and digital or whatever. They made this lens till up until 2005. It's a fairly modern lens, and it's one of those things too. I write this in a lot of articles. I don't really like the unquantifiable, you know, sort of soft descriptors that happen around photography a lot too. It's like, this has 3D pop and this one has character, but you just can't escape it. And when I shoot that lens, the other side of that is I don't know enough about the science of like optical, you know, physics to say, here's exactly what's happening. But this lens does have just a lot of character. You take pictures with it and the pictures look interesting. That's the best way to say it. So that's why I love this one.
It's why it's hard. Well, it's impossible to write about Ducati without using the word passion. Like you just can't, right? Like yeah. I used to have a 749 and eventually I was just like, yeah, this just, it just excites your soul. And you can't explain it.
Yeah.
You just have to go, I just love, you know, it's the same with cameras. Like, I just love picking it up. And if you love picking it up.
It's the Italian thing. It's the bellissimo.
Yeah. Yeah. I read an article recently about Moleskine notebooks that the Italians just did. They did what they do. They made it small and black and wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a, so the 749, you don't have the 749 anymore? It's gone.
No. I trapped a nerve riding it. It was a bit too small for me. I'm very long in the leg. It's adjustable, but it also ultimately being hunched over like that, I do like flat bars. I like kind of naked. Bikes, like Street Fighter bikes and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But the 749 was glorious.
So that's funny. I have a 749 story. It's a short story. It's very short. But so I over the last summer, and we're just about wrapping it up right now, I've been working on a BSA A65 from 1967. So I've been rebuilding this old bike. But I'm approaching in the summertime, as I'm approaching the end of that project, I'm thinking about the next one. I'm like, what's my next project going to be? And there's a huge European motorcycle show that happens up in Brookline, which is like a little area of Boston, every year. And I go to it every year. I put bikes into the show and it's just like one of the best days every year. You go and hundreds of motorcycles from all over New England. It's incredible. It's fantastic. I had it in my mind for about a week before the show. I'm like, I think a Ducati 749, that might be my next project, like early 90 or early 2000 sport bike, you know, something like that. I don't have a bike like that. I've got what you were just describing. I have roadsters, naked bikes, old bikes, you know, the sit up and beg position, as the British used to call
it.
And I go to the show and in rolls the 749. I'm like, ooh, look at that. And if anyone listening has seen the 749, you know it's one of the most beautiful motorcycles ever made.
Yeah.
I go up to the guy later in the show and I'm telling him all this. And he's like, Do you wanna try it on? You wanna take a seat, see if you like it? It's like, absolutely, thank you so much. I get on it and I'm like, no, this is
really?
Absolutely not the bike for me.
Wow.
Felt out just so uncomfortable and foreign and weird. I was just like, I'm not going to be able to ride this. Like, I'm sitting on this bike for a minute and my neck hurts. So,
It's definitely not designed. It's not designed with comfort in mind. It's designed with going around a track really fast in mind. I like the 749 because it looks weird. It's the Ducati that it was when they went super weird with the two headlights on the front. It looks like a droid from Star Wars.
It looks amazing. It's the best looking Ducati. I love it. It's so good. It's a shame I'll never have one.
Yeah. They did a black one as well. Like toward the end of the run, they did a black, like a matte black finish like a satin black finish that was cheaper because it was lower. It was actually, although it looked cool, it was lower spec than the main one. Mm-hmm. It was a cool bike.
It's funny. So they charge less for that. See, Porsche goes the other way. If you get the lower spec one, it's more money. It's like we took out the radio, we took out the AC, the air conditioning. It's lighter. It has no back seats, so it's $40,000 more money.
That's insane.
It's like the race, you know, the race spec or whatever.
Yeah.
Was it the 998 that was in the Matrix? Do you remember that?
Yes. Ducati? Yes, it was.
And
it was the one before.
That green, that incredible green color.
So cool.
Yeah. That's what I had in mind. I was like, I'm going to get like a 749 and paint it that, you know, Matrix green. Well, but
here's what you do, and then listeners, I promise we'll stop talking about motorcycles, but this is a diversion we don't often go on the show, so it's quite fun. You want to go down the if you like the flat bars but you want something that's a hooligan's machine, Hypermotard, something like that, or the Hyperstrada.
I remember when that came out.
Yeah,
that's another thing we should talk about. Well, just for a moment, I'm noticing as I'm getting older, you see like YouTube videos and it's like, I discovered the weirdest, you know, BMW or Ducati, or I discovered the strangest camera that anyone ever made. And then you watch the video and it's like, that came out when I was like in college.
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean? You're, you know, all these younger people are discovering this stuff. And it just makes you feel so old. It's like, don't do this to me. Yeah, don't discover things from my prime as if they're classic examples of something from the old days.
Yeah, yeah. From when I was 13. My daughter.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's not even that long ago. No. They were someone. I was watching a video. Someone was talking about the original, like, Triumph Bonneville T100, which was, you know, the T100 was from like 2005 or something. And they're like, back in the day, it's like, come on.
Yeah,
come on. Stop it. Don't do that. My daughter, I pulled out the third gen iPod. I've got a third gen iPod. I think it's right here. I think it's on my desk. Oh, this is a later one. This is like fourth or fifth or something. I got an older one too. I pulled that out and she's like, what is that? Is that a phone? I was like, no, this is an iPod. She's like, an iPod? Do you know what she said to me? She said, this is an actual quote. She said, you mean from like the olden days? And I'm like, the olden days? Where are you hearing the olden days? No. Yeah.
I'll have you know, it has a fine 30-pin connector. My iPod is also still on my desk. I have a refurbed, like
beautiful. Yeah. It's like an iPod Classic.
But it was the pre-classic. It's the one with the good DAC in. So if you buy them and you look on them, if they have like audiobooks or something at the bottom of the list, then they have they have a different DAC in them for the most part. And so, you know, I've taken it apart and it does. And yeah, it sounds tremendous. Like it turns out.
They're great.
Turns out ripping a CD and putting it on something and playing it back that isn't compressed or streamed, like, sounds really nice. Like the sound stage is broader and it's sort of like dynamic range on, you know, or analog, you know, big prints. Like they just feel nice because you've got space rather than looking at something on a tiny phone. Everything in our lives, like the visual is a metaphor for it, but everything is now compressed and small.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. And another good thing about iPods, this is another boomer take, but you're not going to, your music isn't going to get interrupted by a call or a message or a notification. Yep. You know, you're just listening to music. It's nice.
Yeah. Or it's taken really away. Nice. That's the other thing, because I have bought albums on iTunes in the past that I can't download anymore because the record company doesn't exist. And so
it's just, well, that happens. I mean, you know this. That happens in the video game industry too. Again, we're like, we're all over the place here. This is a camera podcast. But the video game industry, how many games do I have on my PS Vita back there that you click on the icon, it loads up the title screen, and then it just closes and goes back to the main menu. And it's like, this was delisted. You can't play it.
Yeah.
Not here.
Yeah. So. Same with when film stocks go away. It's that thing of, you know, the manufacturing process becomes too complicated or too expensive, or it uses chemicals that are, like, for good reason are now illegal and things like that. Because the Impossible Project was that, you know, is named that for that reason. Like, it was nigh on impossible to bring that stuff back. And Polaroid is still difficult to use and difficult to work with and incredibly expensive compared to, like, other film stocks. You know, at least 35 mil seems to be fairly healthy in air.
I would think so.
Yeah, it's definitely. Yeah.
I mean, I can still go to I can go to Target and buy film. So that's like my litmus test.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
Is it still going? If I go to my Target down the street and there's film there, I'm like, okay, yeah, we're good.
Yeah, I think it's a bit harder over here. I was talking to Anson, who runs Tahuso, who's based in Hong Kong, I think, and he was saying about like developing film costs and stuff. Like in the UK, it's very expensive to develop film. So you're looking for a roll of film all in, including shipping back and forth and scanning. It's best part of £30 to get that done, I suspect. Because the roll of film, I mean, if you're not buying them in large enough quantities to really make, you know, to get any savings on the numbers of film, you're probably paying nearly £10 for a roll of film, you know, for 36. Yeah. So there's that. The developing is at least that again, and then they may charge you extra to scan it, you know, as they should, right? They have to stay in business, like, and it's not free.
I use a couple places. I use a local place, and the guy, you know, is gives me a good deal on the scanning of developing and scanning. If I send it out, I mean, it gets pricey. You buy a roll of film for $10 or whatever, send it to a place. It's gonna be. Yeah, it's going to be $20, I would say, with developing and scanning. So every roll of film, you're looking at $30. So it is pricey. I mean, it's a pricey hobby. It's always been a pricey hobby. I mean, it's not a cheap hobby. When I got into it in like 2014, it was cheaper, but that was 10 years ago. So There's not much you can do about it. I published an article that was, I think it was like, you know, if you're worried about the rising cost of film photography, here's some stuff you can do. And there are some things you can do. You buy in bulk, shoot black and white, learn to develop at home, get a scanner. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's always ways to mitigate the cost, but.
Yeah. Well, on the subject of cost, that's a nice segue onto lens number two, because lens number two can't have been cheap. If a Contax G1 is an investment, the Leica R28 is not a cheap lens.
Yeah, it's a Leica Elmerit 28 2.8. The one that I used was from the 70s. It was the original version of it. But they made pretty much the same lens right up until like 1992. So there's plenty of them out there.
Classic Leica.
I don't know how much money it would be to buy this lens. Let me look. I can just look. I'm on my website, so I'll just click the link. It's about $650 US. Yeah.
Bit more over here from what I was looking, because I had a look the other day. Yeah, because I was tempted, because I've been shooting some Arglass this week. Yeah, with that stupid. Have you seen the thing I've been posting on social media of the?
No.
I've got a Novaflex. Yeah.
Okay.
It's effectively a sniper rifle.
Super long.
Yes.
I did see that with the birds, right?
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. Mm,
very cool.
It looked amazing. I was like, wow, that's a Canon. That's like, it was reminding me of the 500 millimeter reflex lens. That's what you should get. Get a 500 millimeter mirror lens. You get that interesting donut bokeh.
Okay. Yeah, I should have a look at that. Yeah, because the one I've got is a 560 and a 400. It came as a kit. And what's funny is I bought it from this place down south, and someone on Threads said, I think I know where you got that from because I work there.
Okay.
And yeah, basically, as far as I can tell, I was looking up a manual for it. They bought it at auction last January for £175. The auctioneer had it on their website. They sold it to me for £299. So they've not really made anything on it, to be honest. They just wanted it gone, and they shipped it for free next day. So they clearly just wanted rid of it. But it comes in a big aluminium case and a whole thing. Mm-hmm. Like I don't know how far I'll be carrying it, but but it's great for photos of squirrels and birds in the garden. And, especially
mounted. You're not shooting that handheld, right?
So I have been, because I want to take it to the MotoGP.
Oh, wow. That'd be amazing.
Because it has such a vintage look. The coatings... The fact that it's like it's the lowest it will go is 6.8. So you're shooting at f11, f16 quite a lot of the time. So you're quite high ISO. So you get, but you get a kind of a grainy. I mean, you can get rid of the grain as very easily as well. But like it has a quite a nice. The colors are unusual for a digital shot. Like they do. I sent some to my stepdad, and he was immediately like, "Yeah, they look filmy."
Yeah. What year was the lens from?
1990, as far as I can tell. And as far as I can tell, they only made it between 90 and 95 in that configuration. And they may have only made about 200 of them,
I
guess. So
and now you have one.
Yeah, I'm very pleased. And the guy at the camera place was delighted that it was being used, you know?
Yeah. Well, they're meant to be used. So.
Yeah. So how did you come across the 28 then?
So at that time, let me see when I wrote this review. It was 2020. At that time, I was, I think I was still like in my, I need to find the perfect SLR, film SLR phase of life, because I tried rangefinders. I've tried everything. I mean, I've shot every type of camera that exists at this point, but I eventually just came around to, and I wanted to be like a rangefinder guy. Like I wanted to be cool like you, right? I was like, I want to be a Leica guy. I want to be a rangefinder guy. I want to be, medium format guy. Like I want to, because you see what everybody else is posting, and you're like, oh, if only I could have that, I could be that, you know. And that's a trap. We don't want to deal with that. So just divorce yourself of that idea, and just find what you like. And that's what I eventually did. And I was like, I'm a boring guy. I'm like an SLR 35 millimeter, like dad at Disneyland type of photographer. So I went on this quest to find the absolute, my absolute favorite SLR. And I ended up sort of homing in on the Leica R5, which is probably not what everyone would pick. Like you would pick a more mechanical SLR, or you might pick a more automated one. This one's kind of in the middle. It's kind of It's kind of a weird one, but it has everything that I wanted. Aperture priority shooting with exposure compensation. It had a really small form factor. Mm-hmm. It had that like Minolta connection because I'm a Minolta fanboy at heart. Yeah. It also had a red dot on it, which was nice. That like satisfied my wannabe rangefinder guy.
Sure.
So the way I came across the 28, the Leica 28 F 2.8, was just that it came with the camera.
Ah.
And I was like, oh, 28 millimeter. It's not really my focal length. I'm more of like a standard 50 millimeter guy. Like I like subject isolation, 28 kind of, and it's got a 2.8. So it's, you know, it's more of like a, I don't know what you would call it, like a contextual lens, photojournalism even maybe, or landscapes or something. I was like, I'll try it out. And it absolutely blew me away. The results from the lens were just incredible. Like the sharpness. And again, we're going to get into that sort of like frustratingly vague or obtuse descriptors, but it just had this character. Like it just, you know, subjects in the foreground really seemed to like burst from the picture. Shot wide open, you could get some really nice bokeh on a 28 millimeter lens, which isn't easy, and 2.8 is not a fast aperture really when you think about it. So you don't expect that. But for me, like I don't know if other people, some people will relate to this, I'm sure. For me, the feeling I have toward a lens, whether I like a lens or not, it doesn't really go by MTF charts or what is on, you know, somebody's website or a YouTube video. It's like when I get the pictures back or if it's digital, when I see the pictures, it's like, do I get that weird little feeling in my chest? Literally, like it sounds strange to say it, but literally if I see a picture that I made that is just, I don't know exactly why I love it, but like it literally makes my heart like flutter. Yeah. I'm like, this is incredible. I can't believe I made this picture. This is great. Like something happened here. And I say to myself, well, it's the camera or it's the lens. It can't possibly be me, right? I end up loving these things. And that's what happened with this lens. I just, like, the pictures I got, I was like, wow, how is that? There's a shot. If listeners go to the site and they look at the review of this lens, there's a shot of my dog who passed away a couple of years ago, which is very sad because he was, up to this point, he was in, like, every one of my reviews. Oh. There's always a picture of Cooper. Cooper was my golden retriever. There's a shot of him, and I do not understand how it is so sharp and resolved. Right. And like you can see every whisker on this dog's face. And yet, like the background's, it's not like bokeh, but it's, you know, it's blurred enough that he pops. It's just, so that's the test for me. Is like, is there a picture that just stops me in my tracks? And if there is, that's a lens I kind of want to keep and just keep using. So that's the story of that. And I also, I'm not like a Leica shooter. I think, I don't think I'm good enough to get the most out of their gear. but this lens, I was like, wow, I guess I am a Leica guy.
I mean, you are. I've just pulled up the photos. I agree. The photo like that. So I have a similar story with a Zeiss 35-28. That I shot a photo, it's my beloved 35-28, that I shot a photo of my youngest with a leaf in front of his face that I've talked about a couple of times on the podcast.
Yeah.
That I don't really know how that one came together either, but somehow it has that amazing separation and lovely blurring of the background, and it was shot wide open and it was a really sunny day, and it just works. I think 2.8 is underrated. Because I have an Elmerit 28 for the M mount as well, which is a stunning lens, and nobody talks about that lens, and it's tiny, and as you say, contextual photography, because I loved the GR3 and I missed it, but I only really wanted to have one camera to worry about, and so I walked into the store in London, and I was there, I tried it, I walked out the store, and I had that moment where I was like, no, I'm doing the wrong thing, and I walked back in and bought it and left it. And I will never part with that lens. And I think there is something special about 28, because when you get close to things, you know, you can do interesting things with 28. But yeah, Cooper looks amazing in that picture. That is.
Thanks. Yeah, no, that's interesting that you say that about 28, because I've thought that too in the recent past. 28 is interesting because it was never really a focal length that I would have picked. Like I said, I was always like in that 50 millimeter camp, you know? But I think you're right in saying 2.8, you know, 28, 2.8 or 2.8 lenses in general are a little underrated. You know, you see that and you're like, oh, well, it's kind of a slow lens. That is certainly shooting digital. That is way less relevant than it used to be too, with the high ISO that these cameras are capable of. And even film nowadays, film shooters will know this, like the exposure latitude of film today is so much greater than when these lenses were created. So if you get a 2.8, which in the past may have been considered like too slow to really use in most situations, unless it's like midday or, you know, you're using studio lighting or something, that's just doesn't really apply anymore. Like you can eke images out of these, even film that's maybe like 400 ISO with a 2.8, you'll be fine. There's nothing to worry about. Just shoot it and relax and have fun.
it's a funny thing. I think the snobbery around how wide your lens goes, but also
fast apertures, right?
Oh yeah, but and you know, I get it. Like they're in the business cool. of selling you expensive lenses and stuff like that. Yeah, they do. And they
here, I'll show
I
you think, this. This is wow. on my desk too. It's a 1.2. It's not special, guess really. It, yeah. I mean, it's a 50 millimeter Nikon, Nikkor 1.2.
Yeah.
But you know what's funny though? I'm supposed to be writing about this. I've been using it for like a month and I have no desire to write about it because nothing is in focus. The optical coatings aren't great. It's just like nothing sharp, nothing's punchy. So we'll see. This might be another Leica Digilux One
right.
phenomenon.
Yeah.
But you were saying, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, no, but I think you're saying the same thing, which I was going to go to, which is like, eventually something has to be in focus, right? Eventually something when you're new to it, it's why I think portrait mode on phones is teaching people the wrong lesson, which is that blur is the point. And it isn't like it's a clever magic trick, no doubt. Like, well done. You've got depth. You've got some depth information. You can use it for interesting things. And I'm sure that everybody at, Apple Park who works or at Samsung or at Google who works on these phones and works on the camera systems for phones, they sit around and go, how can I recreate the experience that, you know, because they work in cameras, right? So they're going to have Hassies, they're going to have Leicas, they, you know, high-end Canon gear, whatever. They want to recreate that experience in a small device and give that to people, and that's exciting to them and that keeps them working, you know, no shade. But at the same time, the lesson it's teaching people when that's the new thing that they focus on every year in the video is it's kind of teaching you that, like, well, everything has to be blurred. And it's like, well, not really. Like, you know, I love shooting at 5.6. I love shooting at 8. I think I've been in a real F8 and be there mood.
F8 and be there, right?
Yeah, for the last few months. It's great. It's really good. Yeah. It's a good place to be.
That's one of my most popular articles, actually, was sort of the I wrote about the origin of that phrase, F8 and be there, and sort of, you know, in a fun way, explored what that means and, you know, what it means sort of philosophically, as well as where the phrase came from, what it means technically and what it means philosophically. So, and I think a lot of the comments were, you know, mirroring what we're saying that, you know, yeah, you know, F8 is a great place to be.
Were you there? Did you photograph the people that you liked? And was it all sharp enough? Like then calm down. Then, like you say, you're not doing this for your job. I went to a thing, like I like to say I'm a tourist, but I went to Fotografiska, I think it's called, in the photo museum in Stockholm, because I go to Stockholm quite often for work, and I like to go there. And they had a Peter Lindbergh exhibition on of all the model photography from the 90s of like there's Naomi Campbell and Cindy Crawford and whoever.
Yeah.
And they'd blown the photos up to kind of gallery ceiling height. Right. So you could like really walk up to this thing that he'd shot on his Nikon, whatever, back in the day. And the thing that stood out was when you actually get close to these images and they're that big, you realize how as you get closer, it's not pin sharp in focus. It's not like there is some motion blur. There is what. And it absolutely didn't matter. Like the images were still incredible, you know, and it's that thing of don't zoom in on your images. Like it's not doing anything for you.
That first editing phase where you're just looking at thumbnails is so important for me anyway, especially just in a workflow, from a workflow standpoint. You know, I've got so many pictures to go through. You just look at them in a thumbnail, and if any of them catch your eye, you zoom in on it and you're like, oh, okay, good one.
Yeah.
And if none of them catch your eye and you zoom in on it, you're like, yeah, bad one. Okay. Yeah. I can trust the thumbnail.
Yes. Does it spark joy? I think is the thing, because I tend to bin stuff rather quickly. I don't know whether you keep stuff
around. I've heard that in your episodes, and I am stunned by that. I'm on the other side. I'm like, how can you get rid of an image? How can you do that?
Because it wasn't, well, for me, thousands of them now are trees since I moved. And so I'm also doing that thing of, it feels a bit different when I'm on a trip. Like if I've gone somewhere. So if I go somewhere for work, even though I get to travel a lot for work, there's no guarantee I'll go back. Right. So like if I'm in New York for a bit, or like years ago, I've gone to Tokyo and stuff. I think it will probably keep more of those, even if they're less interesting or whatever. Just kind of like out of some sense of like, well, I bothered to press the shutter. I must have thought there was something there at the time. And I may take a bit longer with those. But stuff around the house or with the family and things like that, I'm making so many photos every year.
Yeah.
I think I'll know whether I got it. Like in
it, and you need a server.
Well, I do. I've got my little NAS that I can I tag stuff, and I use Lens Tagger, you know, because it wouldn't be an episode of Prime Lenses if I didn't shout out Lens Tagger, because it's really good. But you know, there comes a point. These things are also likely to be trapped on a computer somewhere unless I bother to print them. I need to put more stuff in books.
Yeah, well, printing is huge. Again, like I've said this a lot already, and this is some people probably tired of hearing, but I wrote an article about how important it is for people to print their stuff, you know, print your pictures. It's really, and if you don't do it and you hear someone say that, you're apt to say like, meh, it's not going to be that sort of interesting an experience thing. They're just kind of like, you know, how real is that? But once you start doing it, you're like, oh yeah, I should have listened to all those people that told me that I'm going to want a hard copy of this.
Yeah. It's even if you just get something like a Canon Selfie, you know, those little dye sublimation printers, like, because they're really good. They do an edge to edge print fairly cheaply, and you can give them to people, and then, you know, they print fairly quick. They're a great starting point. We had one of those. I gave it away because I've got a better printer now. So I sort of gave that to a friend's daughter who is interested in photography. And so I was like, cool, do that.
And if you're a gear nerd, which probably a lot of the people listening, probably a lot of the people that read my site are gear nerds. Mm-hmm. It's a whole new thing to explore. Yes. Like you've got a whole nother year or so of just looking up stats and figuring out how these things work. And, oh, this one does this DPI or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So just embrace that. It's great. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Lose yourself to it. And also, like, if like me, you smugly sit there going, no, I don't shoot film, it's too expensive, let me tell you about ink and paper, my friend.
Oh, yeah.
Boy, howdy. That's that's not cheap. My stepdad was talking to me.
Nothing is cheap.
No, nothing's cheap. He was like, why don't you buy the off-brand ink? And I was like, no. Mm. I'm not spending a load of money on a printer and then putting weird off-brand ink in. It might be good. It might be fine. But I'm fully... like Kool-Aided. I'll just, here you go, Canon. Just,
well, you know, I agree with you. You'll get no argument.
No, it's got to be right. No. Well, on the subject of right, so the last lens, because I don't know what this one is. What's your third choice?
So like I said, I had a lot of trouble with this. I'm going through all these reviews that I've written over the last 10 years, and I'm like, oh yeah, that was a great camera. That was a great lens. And you know, you mentioned the GR3, and I was close to doing the GR1V. The 28-2.8 that's in that, because that lens is like a legend. That is one of the best lenses ever made, probably the best lens ever put in a compact camera. Just absolutely incredible. And I've talked to, I'm friends with Ned Bunnell. Have you heard of Ned? He was the former president of Pentax in the United States. So we talk all the time, and he's got Ricohs, and he's just obsessed. So we're always talking about how, oh, you know, these lenses are amazing. He's got amazing stories. You should have him on this. That would be amazing.
Yeah.
I'll tell him about it. Because he's a like a fountain of information. He was one of these guys that, I mean, he was living it. He was running Pentax, going to Tokyo all the time for trips to meet with the Japanese lens designers, the camera designers.
Oh, amazing.
He launched a bunch of really interesting Pentax cameras. But anyway, we're getting off subject. I'm just giving an extra push for the Ricoh GR crowd there. You know,
love them.
You guys are smart. But the lens I picked, and this is interesting because we just spent the last 10 minutes talking about how bokeh isn't everything. Mm-hmm. And in fact, bokeh is overrated. My lens, the third lens that I was most interested in, is the Sony STF 100 millimeter 2.8, which is a smooth transfocus lens. Have you ever heard of these?
No, I don't know that one.
So it's a modern lens for like Sony's E mount. So Sony's, you know, A series. And I'll say the name of it so everyone can look it up. It's the FE 100 millimeter F2.8 STF GMOSS. Lots of letters.
Yeah.
And what it is, it's a smooth transfocus lens, which means it has a apodization filter that blurs the background and the foreground bokeh while also keeping a pretty generous swath of sort of data, I guess, in the middle in like super, super sharp focus.
Wow.
And this was a lens that is extremely specialized. This is not like just your average sort of short tele lens. Definitely made for a specific purpose, and that purpose is entirely to blur as much as you possibly can besides the thing you're focused on. Yeah. And on paper and saying it, it's like, okay, it sounds kind of boring. It sounds like, okay, you're just going to get like a normal portrait shot. You're going to put your kid there six feet away from you, and you're going to take a portrait, and you know, their eye will be in focus, but their ear may be a little blurrier, and the back of their hair will be a little blurrier still, and the background will be blurry. But what happens with this lens is literally everything that you're taking a picture of, besides the foreground and background, is the sharpest picture you'll ever see. It's so incredibly clear. And then the background and the foreground are the blurriest pictures you'll ever see. So it's... Wow. It's such a specialized lens. And I remember when I got it from B&H as a test. And I thought, nah, okay, we'll write about it. It'll be fun. It's not gonna blow my mind. If you go to the site and look at some of my pictures, like I'm not the best photographer in the world, I admit that freely. But there's like shots on this review that no other lens could do. And I know that that's said a lot in the photography space, but it's absolutely true for this.
I'm looking at the pictures now. They are the ones of the bees and the blades of grass and stuff really make your point. That's
incredible,
insane.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, and you look at that and you might say like, oh, I could probably do that with like an 85 1.4 or like I could maybe do that. But I've shot all those lenses too. Mm. And I've taken the same pictures and they're not like this. This is like technology. Minolta invented this. Again, going back to my Minolta fanboyism. Oh. Minolta invented this lens, I think in the 90s, and it was really, really good. It did a lot of what this Sony version does.
Right.
But then, as most people listening probably will know, Sony bought Minolta's camera business in the early 2000s, and that's what launched Sony as this like amazing camera maker. So they owned all of Minolta's patents and everything, and Sony improved. They took this lens and improved it to just an unbelievable degree. This is such a fine lens. And I think I ended the review saying like, I think I said basically what I'm saying here, that like, I didn't expect to really find anything super interesting with this lens.
Mm.
But at the end of my 3 weeks with it, I was so distraught to send it back to B&H, because they send me loaner gear. I don't get to keep this stuff. Yep. So there are very few lenses that like really cause me heartache when I have to send them back, but this is one of them. And I don't have one because I don't shoot Sony really anymore. I've kind of switched over to Nikon.
Yeah.
But yeah, this lens is incredible.
It really looks like something else.
And not a lot of people know about it. That's another thing.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned this lens to people and they're just like, well, I've never heard of that.
No.
And it's not that much money. I mean, it's a lot of money. It's about $1,500.
Yeah.
But when you see what it can do.
Yeah.
I don't know why every portrait photographer doesn't have this lens.
It must be that they don't really know about it. I've heard of all the really fancy ones and like, you know, the 1.4s and the massive tellies. Not this one.
No, this is one of the best lenses I've ever used. And I've been doing this for 10 years.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Shooting a different thing every week.
Yes.
And you know what's weird about this too is the autofocus was amazing. I was shooting this on like, I don't know, I mean almost prehistoric A7, I think original A7 and maybe an A7 II as well.
Mm-hmm.
But like there's a shot on this in this review of a bubble that my daughter blew.
Yes, that's cool.
Somehow this camera focused on a bubble like floating through the air perfectly. It's just amazing. I couldn't believe it when I saw that.
Yeah. No, that's wild. That's really, really good. I have friends who shoot a lot of Sony gear. I need to ping them a link to that afterwards.
Yeah.
Because that's
it's a special one. And if you're interested in like kind of wacky stuff too, it's very fun to just, you know, poke around with something like this.
Yeah. I mean, I think if not to sound all Sean Bean, but one does not accidentally listen to a podcast about lenses in that kind of way.
Sound all Sean Bean.
Yeah. I can't do the voice. Yeah.
No. But this lens is a gift.
Yes. Yes.
That's another Sean Bean. It is a gift.
I love that man. Yeah. He's very good. Yeah. I haven't seen him around in a while, actually. Don't know what he's up to.
Yeah. Yeah, who knows? No. Who knows? Who knows what he's up to?
He's done enough.
I love the stories. I'm a big, big Lord of the Rings nerd, and I finally got my daughters to watch the first Lord of the Rings movie, Fellowship of the Ring. She was like terrified. My daughter is 9 years old, and she was terrified of it. She's like, "It's gonna be scary," you know, for like two years. She's probably too young to watch it, but you know, I push things into push this stuff that I like onto them a little bit. But she finally watched it, and she the big Boromir reveal at the end, the big turn.
Yeah.
That rocked her.
It does. When characters betray you and you trusted them.
Oh, yeah. And
yeah. We've been very careful because, like, my eldest is 10 and my youngest is 6. And so we've kind of... They're both fairly, like, scaredy cats. Like, they love Star Wars Lego, but they don't love stressful things on screen and stuff. And so we've been really careful about what we've watched. When they were younger, we got the opening 30 seconds of Madagascar when the lion jumps up and goes boo. That was enough. So we've kind of been very careful. Okay. So we haven't watched Star Wars stuff, but Skeleton Crew has been really good. The new TV show, because it's kind of in little increments and it's kind of like the Goonies. But it's
it's got like a Spielberg-esque sort of sensibility.
Amblin would have made it in the 80s. Yeah. You know, it's that kind of vibe. So we've kind of been eking towards it. But I'd love to put Lord of the Rings in there. That'd be really cool.
Oh, yeah. Eventually, they'll get there. She loves it now. I mean, I'm so proud, you know. I was probably 10 years old when I read Lord of the Rings. So I'm a big nerd. I can't get away from it. I must embrace it.
Yeah. Well, I've seen your daughter in photos, like holding cameras as well, and Insta stuff. Like, does she like kind of what you're doing? Is it because you're the cool dad still when they're little?
In a way, sure. Yeah. She's both of my daughters. I've got daughters that are a similar age to yours. Mine are 9 and 7. They'll be 10 and 8 this year, early this year. So they're getting older, but, they're great. They're into everything, which I love. Cool. I just love that. They really want to explore things and be sort of involved. So when we're doing stuff, they want to know what it's all about.
Yeah.
And obviously cameras is a big part of that. I've given them a lot of cameras over the years that they have destroyed.
Yep.
You know? And they get another one, that's fine, you know. It's just because I have the camera shop too. That's another part of my business, and so there's always stuff coming in, and they cost me a lot of money as far as destroying products that could have been sold. But
I live in fear of my youngest breaking the X10 that we have, because I've looked up how much they are to replace, and a 12-year-old camera should not cost that much money.
No.
We were given it.
A
friend sent us a box. He said, we have some old cameras. Do your kids want them? And I went, sure. Yes, that would be amazing. Yeah.
You were like, I want them.
Well, So the X10 came along with a Sony NEX5 where the shutter is stuck, unfortunately. Oh, so it doesn't, it will take one photo and then the shutter jams and it
you have to shut it off
and you have to turn it off and turn it back on again and it will take another one. I haven't been able to get that fixed, but the X10, my youngest loves it. It takes it out all the time, and we've also got, I see you've got the SQ, the Instax Square in the background as well. We've got one of those too.
That's right. Yeah, that's, I do great. Have that, yeah.
Such a cool camera.
Yeah, we've got a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff here. Goes back to that hoarding thing that I mentioned, or maybe I didn't mention. Maybe I just thought it. But when we were talking about saving every picture, I was like, I looked in the background of my office here, and I was like, okay, there's a psychological aspect happening
there
as well. Yeah. So.
We all collect stuff. I mean, in the blurred out background in the picture that listeners can't see, there's stuff in my background that looks like books. It's all video games. Like there's it's Wii U games and Switch games and CDs and
the Wii U. Wow, you're a real one.
Well, I didn't think it was a bad system. I liked it. I have friends at work who tell me I'm wrong because they had to develop for the thing, and they were like, no, it was a disaster. But as a consumer, I loved it. When I pre-ordered the Switch, I went into the video game store I was pre-ordering it in, and I went in. I was like, yeah, because I really like my Wii U, and the guy stopped and went, "Do you?" Like he thought it was a bit.
He's
no
calling everybody over. Hold on. Wait here. Don't go anywhere.
He's the guy. This is the guy. And I was like, yeah, let me tell you about Pikmin 3. It's amazing. It's project management, the game.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So is that Star Fox game too. It's like I just wanted Star Fox, and then it was holding up the
gamepad
screen. And
do you have any white whale gear that you're going to try and get this year for the site and to kind of cover? Or
I have had a camera that I've wanted to shoot for years now, and they're rare, they're expensive. And I haven't gotten it. And what it is, and you know what? I think other people have covered it now at this point. Like when I first said, I want to get one of those, there was nothing online about these things. But now I think I've seen a couple of like YouTube videos in the last year or so. But it's the Zeiss Hologon, the original film camera with the fixed super wide angle lens. I think it was a 16mm. They made a Hologon for like the G series, and they've made like 16mm wide angle lenses for other systems. But this was, I think, the camera that it launched in. Mm. And it was F8 only lens, 16mm, fitted in basically just like a 35mm film camera body. No bells, no whistles, just a super wide focal length. And I really want to shoot one of those. But like I say, they're, you know, we're talking $4,000 or $5,000 for a film camera that has one lens. Not a lot of resale value, I would think. Like, there's not a big market for people. So typically when I buy a piece of gear for the site, I've got to think about where it's going afterwards, because I would quickly go bankrupt with a basement full of $5,000 cameras.
Yes.
So I really want one. It's going to be a hard thing to sell after I write about it. But, you know, sometimes readers come through and they're like, hey, I've got one of those if you want to borrow it. And that's like amazing. That's such a gift. Totally appreciate that. But that hasn't happened with with the Hologon yet.
No.
We'll see.
Oh, hope springs. That's really good. Yeah. Well, I should let you go because you have to go and pick up your little one fairly soon.
Fairly soon. Yeah.
And we've covered some awesome lenses. And I fear that we would just end up talking tons about video games.
Video games, motorcycles.
How many bikes do you have these days? Just so I can be jealous, because I only have the one these days.
Well, I've got three.
Oh, well done.
I've got three. I'd say one of them is like totally finished. So don't get too jealous. One of them will be finished in about a month. So that's good. The other one is an ongoing project. So I like British stuff. So it's probably very boring stuff to you. You've probably seen it your whole life.
Yeah.
Triumphs and BSAs.
BSAs like, and stuff,
Like the Harley Davidsons of the Americas, you know, it's like
we see
a Harley and it's like, this guy's it's just a Harley.
No.
go to Japan with a Harley Davidson and everyone falls over.
Well, you see tons. When I've been to Tokyo, you see tons of Harleys around, like really old, Harley Davidson's being ridden around. They'll often do the thing you want them to do in Tokyo. They've added lights, they've added all sorts of stuff. They've got they've cut off the pipes like this. There's some really, really strict noise regulations in Japan. And when Ducati launched the Panigale there, it was too loud and they had to add this aftermarket awful, it looked like a drinking straw attached to the exhaust. It was just dreadful. But it also looked very much like it came off very easily.
Yeah, you know.
You know, just, oh no, where, I just, where, this fell where, off.
Yeah, where there's a will, there's a way.
So. Yeah, always. This has been amazing. I think we've had a really, I've enjoyed this very much. It's been long overdue as well. I can't believe it. I'm sort of stunned. Like, we got to the end of an hour or so of talking. It's like, I actually didn't think, because there have been a few times we've like nearly done this and then not quite. And we should definitely talk about writing, because that's also something that we talked about last year.
Yeah.
I'd love to contribute if you're interested in some thoughts on a 560, 400 millimeter gun-like setup with some great shots of woodpeckers. Yeah.
No, cool. That'd be wonderful. That goes back to, you know, and if this doesn't fit into the podcast, just edit this stuff out. I'm sure you're going to go through and edit and find the best bits. But yeah, it goes back to sort of refocusing in 2025. I definitely want to find like a core group of contributors who are, you know, able and willing to contribute consistently so that the voice becomes consistent and the readers get to know people. Because I think that was like the greatest strength, one of the great strengths of the site when we were really going like full speed with a good group of writers, is that like readers developed relationships with people. Yeah. Like they knew, you know, Josh Solomon was a writer for a long time and he still writes, but he's very busy with his work and everything else. So it's fewer and far between. But, you know, people would say like, oh, you know, you just develop that history with someone, you see their name on it, on the byline, and you're like, oh, okay, I know, you know, I've read this guy's stuff for the last 2 years. I know his opinion sort of like resonates with me and we share ideas and stuff like that. So, So it'd be great. It would be great to have a small core group of people that we can, you know, and I'd love to have you on to do that if you're interested. So
no pressure. I'd love to. But I'll take your hand off. I'd love to do it. I mean, you've already covered my beloved Zeiss, so that one's already there, but the 560
have 400.
I think 35? So I think you've got the Biogon C, because I didn't like the Biogon, the F2 version. I had it last year and thought it was it was a bit unremarkable. It was very good, and that was the problem, actually, was that it was just fine. You know, there was nothing. Yeah. Whereas the 2A is just a bit antique feeling and weird, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's got something about it.
Yeah. The other one's too perfect.
Yeah.
Too clinical.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, really good. It's such a privileged, stupid thing to say that, like, this really well made thing that is a really reasonable price for the quality that it produces bored me. And so, you know. But that's how I once ended up with a 1300cc motorcycle, not an 800, because I rode the BMW F800 and went, that's boring. And they went, perhaps I would like one of these. And I did. Yeah, I had a 1300cc K, and it was amazing. Loved that bike.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
It was such a cool bike.
Again, we're going to get onto motorcycles again for another 10 minutes, but so just stop me. But I think a BMW R series is going to be my next project.
Ah, okay.
An old one, boxer motor.
Yes, yeah. Like the 9T or those kind of styles.
Older. Oh, yeah, right. 70s. We're talking R60/5 or 75/5.
So, yeah.
Yeah. We would be great buddies if we lived down the street from each other.
We'd
be hanging out, motorcycles, cameras all day, playing video games.
That'd be very cool. We'll just have to be like global 21st century neighbors, you know?
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, brilliant. All right, man. Well, I will leave you to it. I'm going to go air fry some potato wedges.
Very nice. All right, thanks so much for having me. Thanks for your time, and thanks to the listeners. I hope we've entertained you a little bit and I didn't bore you guys too much.
You have been a fantastic guest. You've been brilliant company. Thank you. And we'll have to have you back on again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, cool.
All right, take care.
See you soon.
Bye.
My thanks again to James for taking the time to be on the show. I really enjoyed that one. It was a good one. If you enjoyed it, don't forget that you can rate and review the show wherever you listen to your podcasts, whether that's Apple Podcasts or Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube, wherever it is. Don't forget to subscribe and share the show with a friend if you're enjoying it. You can also sign up to the weekly newsletter on ianfarrell.com/sign-up and support the show on Patreon if you would like to help pay for hosting and email bills and all that sort of jazz. Right, well, get outside. There's probably some nice light where you are. Take a trip on your motorcycle. Take your camera with you. Take a photo of your motorcycle. Who knows? But anyway, get out into the world, have a great week. We'll see you next time.